I'm here in Ballyturbet and I'm talking to Patrick O'Reilly.
How do you announce it?
And I'm also talking to his wife, Anne O'Reilly. And Anne, your maiden name was Sheridan.
That's right.
And where did you come from, Anne, originally?
Well, I'm from County Cavan. I'm from a place called Ballyhillan, Crossdoney, which is about 15 miles here from Ballyturbet.
And did you grow up in a farming background?
I did, yeah. We had a farm. You know, small cabin farm, dairy farm, and my parents, Michael Sheridan and Isabella Sheridan, Nee Kelly, and I was an only child, so I always think of only children as when they're growing up, that they're just little adults because they're with adults all the time, and I heard all the conversations that my father and mother had about all the different happenings during their lifetime in the country, and also all the friends and neighbours and all who would come into the house. That was ongoing.
And you were born in 1942. So.
Yeah.
So you grew up in the 50s and 60s, long before the Troubles.
Oh, yes.
So life was...
Life was, yeah, very...
Normal.
It was very normal and it was a simple life, country life in County Cavan.
Tell me what happened then when the Troubles broke out.
Well, we were very, you know, we saw what led up to it in so far as that they had the civil rights people. Had their different marches, and then you know, they were stopped on many occasions by the authorities, and the follow up to that, they just, how would I, what did I see? They would that impacted on us a lot because things had been quiet. Let's say that quiet previous to that in my lifetime. There was trouble in the early 1940s, as I was told at a later stage, but I wouldn't have been aware of any of that. I was too young. But certainly the 50s were reasonably quiet, and it was, you know, I feel that all Irish people at that time, the vast majority of Irish people, could see the injustices that were being suffered by the nationalists in the six counties. And everybody was really felt, you know, these are our people and we're behind what they're trying to do to get freedom for themselves. Freedom just for to have a vote in some cases, and freedom to live their lives in a normal way, because they couldn't do that. They were second class citizens. They just couldn't do that. And that's what they were trying to acquire for themselves. My uncle, Tom Sheridan, was killed in 1920. He was 23 years old at that time. And all my father's family and his all his people were all very nationalistic, and they were all, of course, very much impacted on the fact that the 1916 had taken place. It wouldn't have really had a big effect in Cavan, I suppose, or as in all many other parts of the country, until the leaders of 1916 were taken out and shot. And I think that's what brought the whole country to realise how I don't know if vicious is the word, but how the authorities were trying to deal with them and trying to suppress them.
And your father, was he involved in any way in politics?
Well, he was involved in the War of Independence, and then at a later stage, in 1920, his brother Tom was killed on the Ballinagh Crossdoney Road. It was a hold-up. The company that he was with, they tried to take the arms off two policemen who were going travelling down to Crossdoney Fair. And the company was in behind the ditch, and they stopped the policemen, asked them to drop their guns, which the two of them did,
And my Uncle Tom was in charge, and he jumped out from behind the ditch and he went to lift up the guns, and the sergeant had a revolver in his inside pocket, and he pulled it and he fired on him and he was shot. He died 2 days later in the Mater Hospital in Dublin. It was quite a long story to tell you about how he got from there to the Mater Hospital, but that's what happened to him.
Tell me about your father now.
My father was Michael Sheridan, and he was born and reared in a small farm a couple of miles from where he subsequently lived, a place called Drumcrow, beside Ballinia village. Paddy, you get that?
Okay.
And he was a great admirer and later on a follower of Eamon de Valera. And when Fianna Fáil was set up first in the early stages, early 20s, he would have done a lot of organising in his own local area and in County Cavan. He stood for election in 1927 for the Fianna Fáil party, but he was not elected. Subsequently, he was elected in the 1932 election, and he was elected in every election after that until he retired in 1961. It was an election of that year, and he... due to bad health, he was unable to stand, and we had many callers to the house, as you can imagine, during all those years, during those years when I was growing up,
and he was part of what?
Part of the all the that
oh he
place.
Was yeah, but
he was what? he was the representative for County Cavan, was a constituency on its own at that time, and there were three representatives, usually. Not always, but two Fianna Fáil and one Fine Gael, or you know, it varied a little bit, but that's the general line of things at that stage.
So you grew up in a very Republican background.
Background,
then.
Yes.
Yeah. And did you grow up in the same kind of background, Patrick?
No, not really. But
where did you grow up?
Laggan is a townland on the border where the George Mitchell Bridge crosses it now. And my mother, being from down the road in Fermanagh, were very conscious growing up of the discrimination. Votes were, in local elections, it was unionist people, votes for every £5 of valuation they had a vote. And if you had small farms of land, you were below it, and you had no vote. So that's how, and then in nationalist areas, the extreme example was always Derry City, 75% nationalist. 20 of a council, 12 unionist, and 8 nationalist. And that was done by gerrymandering, by giving a seat in the nationalist areas for a huge population, and then giving us, for those unionists, giving them a seat for a street.
Yeah.
And then in jobs and in housing. Now, we were conscious there along the border that there was no nationalist person. A postman, hardly, you know, jobs like that. Discrimination in jobs, like all state jobs were all unionists, no nationalists got a job on a council or anything.
I see. And were you farming there?
Oh, I was farming for generations there. And then my mother was reared on a farm in Fermanagh. So, another thing that always struck me forcefully, I'd cycle down when I was a young lad in my teens to see my grandmother and my grandfather.
Oh, where did she live? And
did 3 miles down in Fermanagh. And where down Lough Erne. That's where my mother come from.
What was the name of the place?
Riley Wood.
Riley Wood.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
And I would be stopped by neighbours who'd usually have someone that I wouldn't know. You had, on the unionist side, to keep control, you had them out from the waiting, 6 or 8 of them every evening, with rifles, stopping people. Some of them would know you rightly. What's your name, sir? Where are you going, sir? What time will you be home, sir? Why are you going there, sir? You know, this sort of thing. And it was very intimidating on nationalist people. And from 1920 up until the collapse of Stormont, you had that going on. Plus the fact that a lot of them was in small farms. But while a man would get £1 a day for doing a little bit of building or that, they were getting, at that time in the 50s, £12 a week. And there'd be about 8 of them would go out. But if you knew there was no check on them at night, two of them would be left and the other ones would go to bed and they got their week's pay for it.
I see. See, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that Paddy was talking about the B specials.
Aye, that was the B specials.
You have to sort of...
Yeah, and...
That was the B specials.
But wasn't there a horrific murder took place on the farm beside you with the bullocks there?
Oh, but that was during the Troubles now. But I'm talking about the period before that.
Oh,
from
yeah.
1920 up until 1970. You had ones patrolling every road where there was nationalists.
So
and keeping an eye on them.
Even patrolling at that time, before the Troubles?
Oh, God, yeah. That went on from 1920 up until 1970.
At different times.
Not every night.
Okay.
But for those nationalist areas, you would be stopped and asked where you were going or where you were going.
So, Patrick, you lived there right beside a Helene Bridge. And looking across the way, you were looking at the bullocks' land and farm and house. And you were very friendly with them.
Sure, we'd be side other and we'd be talking every other day, you know, up and down, and people were walking and cycling, and there was great contact with people. If you look back when there was no cars, when you were walking or cycling, people along the road, you stopped for a bit of a chat, and people.
And did you get to know what's his name? Yeah,
the story that would be. Joan Bullock's husband. We would have went to school, a little school over the road, Kilcorby School, a lovely lady there, Mrs. Wilson, Church of Ireland, and I went there from 1943 to 1946, and it was the same around a lot of rural areas. Children, when there was no transport, if it was further than 2 or 3 mile, a child of 5 couldn't walk, so they went to the nearest school until they were at 7, whether that was short of iron or like after. So we local short of iron neighbours all my life would be friendly because the ones I went to school with, you know.
Yeah, and so during the summertime, would you help them out in the farm?
We did. It was quite often to borrow things like rollers and implements they wouldn't use too often during the year, you know?
Yeah.
Neighbours would lend them or borrow them or further. Yeah.
So everything was very friendly then.
Yeah.
Until the Troubles. When the Troubles started then, was there a sense of keeping away or not trusting one another? Or?
Well, no, not so much. You just didn't talk about it, you know? Your meeting and that and... If there was things on the news, you just didn't talk about it.
Helene Bridge was blown up then. And so did that stop you even more from making...
It had a dramatic effect because it meant that neighbours have worked together at maybe at here, Silage, the Bullocks, and another man, Kieran's down the road from us, and helped me. You could no longer do that because it was 12 or 14 mile by road around. So we're just cut off. And as most of us said, the time that the new road was opened, anyone that was under 15 in the early 70s, when the road was blown up on both sides, they were total strangers because they didn't know other.
I know.
People are cut off of the road.
Yeah.
So families on both sides along the border, while they might be in view of the house, once there was in the early teens, they knew nobody.
But
in 79.
Yes, but as soon as the bridge was blown up there, and you witnessed this all because you were living there
beside it,
and straight after that, even before that, you had a bus thrown over the bridge.
Yeah.
There were young lads.
Mainly, I just wasn't there, but I heard who was there. There were teenagers. They thought it was fun. The bus was burned, and they gathered of a son and thought this great sport, we'll tip it into the river.
And that's what happened.
Aye. But it had been burned. The shell of the bus was on the road for some time.
But why burn out a bus?
Well, why? Why anything?
Why
buses were a target, weren't they?
Oh, God, Belfast buses were, and there you were a target.
Yeah.
And
it was done every day up there.
But it was bringing people down to Belturbet, was it?
They used to come into Belturbet,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then it stopped, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Well, the bridge was gone.
The bridge was gone.
Yeah. And so you had that, and then you had the Bailey Bridge was built.
Yeah.
And of course, that didn't last too long.
The Bailey Bridge only lasted a matter of 5 or 6 weeks.
Less even.
Less. The British Army blew it out of it altogether.
That was never proved.
And a lot of ones got free. There was good girders and that. Ones went to Daniel Greiner. They didn't take it away, you see. But they blew it and it was mangled.
But to start with, that bridge was a historical. It was a magnificent bridge.
Oh, yeah.
And completely destroyed now.
Well, the first thing the British Army blew was the centre
aisle
of it. They blew the centre aisle out of it. And then the government, Cavan County Council, got the army to put a Bailey bridge across. There was 3 aisles in the bridge and one was blown. So they put this Bailey steel bridge across it.
Yeah.
But it only lasted a matter of weeks. The British Army come back again and blew it out of it.
Was there a man killed crossing the bridge?
No.
Johnny Maguire.
But he wasn't killed. No, he got drowned. He was trying to cross on stepping stones, wasn't that it?
No, the Bailey Bridge had been blown, but the rail of it was there, and he used to come to town every night. And it actually, the night before, I left him out and waited with the lights of the car till he had got across, and he waved at me. Someone else left him out the next night and thought he was across, but he fell into the river. You know, it was dark night.
Mm-hmm. No, he wasn't killed.
Okay, so it was an accident, really.
Yeah.
That man Johnny Maguire.
Yeah. But you were in the heart of it. I mean, there was so much going on around that bridge. You know, Haldane Bridge was the main link to Enniskillen from Cavan.
Yeah.
It must have upset you.
Well, it did, because you had a lot of people there along the border, married both sides and had family connections, you know, and if someone was sick or a funeral to ground to Timor, it was an awful journey to go around, and then you had to go through checkpoints, you know, whereas...
But could you not just cross the river in a little boat?
Ah, well, they had boats. Yeah, well, there were a few boats there, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But that wasn't an easy thing, because you had to have another car.
You had to have another car on the far side, you see.
On the other side.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
But you still got on okay, like you farmed away on one side and you...
Yeah, but you couldn't go up or down, our neighbours couldn't come up with a tractor or an implement to work. You were cut off, unless you went round or they came round. You know, you wouldn't be talking to them. You saw them cross the river away in the distance. Whereas, you know, you'd be talking to them every other day or that, because you'd be going up and down the road, you know.
But did that also psychologically, did you feel, look, you know, that mistrust started to fall, become part of everything because you were now divided, you know?
The mistrust wasn't with our neighbours.
No.
The mistrust was with
the British government.
The British government. And their agents.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. How long did you remain there, Patrick, before you were living there too, Anne? Were you for a while?
Yeah. We were 8 years there. Paddy was all his life there, we were 8 years after our marriage, we were living there. And then we came in here.
And that was the 8 years of the Troubles?
We got married in 1968, and then the trouble started in 1969, and so it was from that. We came in here in 1976,
How terrible was it when you heard the news of the Bullock killing of both
Tommy Bullock and his wife,
Well, now, to be honest, the rumour was going around a while before that he had been warned.
How do you mean now? Why?
The British Army picked him up. I remember I was out at home, and one morning around 7 o'clock before I got up, an awful noise over there. The British Army was flying, and they did about 6 miles in a helicopter, and he was spotted going in the helicopter with them, and they were photographing all the houses in on this side of the on the Cavan side of the border, and it was thought then that they were identifying Catholic houses. If things got bad enough, I don't know for what motive. But that was loose, that was talk now that was going on. And we heard at that time...
He was a member of the...
He'd have been a member of the B Specials now, come back before that, you see. And the British Army helicopter was plenty of noise of it. And one was aware it was dropping and picking him up. And that had went on numerous times. And then people recognised the army helicopter in this side. No, we didn't have helicopters on. No, you tell the guards, you know, about it. And that would sort of... that's what happened in his situation.
I see, I see.
Yeah.
So he was... Did he get a warning?
It was said that he did. You know, how would you know?
These things can't be proved.
You
know, what it was said.
It was said that he got a warning not to be getting up on the helicopter and photographing houses this side the border.
I see.
Yeah. Now, the difference with the other bullocks, a different family, this story, and the people there at Ahalane, they never had any part in... would be specials or any organisation. And they were in for... they would have come from a Methodist background and they were in for peaceful living, you know, and they didn't agree with being in an army or anything like that. And they were good neighbours. And the same with some other Protestant neighbours that could come up here quite openly because they weren't involved in the B specials or they weren't involved in anything like that. And I may have mentioned to you the last time, and you didn't believe it, that my Uncle Tommy, there was 25 guards played in his house of a Sunday night, and there was 5 Catholics and 3 Protestants, and that went on all during the 70s and 80s. But those Protestant men that were going in, they were farmers like himself, but they weren't carrying a gun.
They weren't part-time UDR?
No. Yeah. The ones that got shot was ones that was carrying guns, not ones that wasn't carrying guns.
Yeah.
And the ones that were at that, they were very easy to see. If a hot day, going to a market and listen to skier and a skilling in the month of July,
yeah,
and farmers would have their coats off.
Yeah.
The ones that was in UDRB specials, they had revolvers tucked in and they had to wear a loose coat. But of a hot day, sometimes if they moved the coat, you could see the butt of the... They had 2 revolvers on them. And they were the ones who were shot at. The ones that didn't carry a gun, nobody shot them. It was the ones who were carrying guns that got shot at.
And did you know the perpetrators? Did you know the guys that...
There wouldn't have been locals that done it.
There were fellas that came up from the country.
Oh, no, there wouldn't have been. Maybe they might have been 50 miles away. But it wouldn't have been 2 locals. But some local... you know, had to tip them off on the house where they were going to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that wouldn't be talked about, you know. Because they went down, that was my favourite lock in the evening. And heard another woman have 2 prams. There was a little shop belonging to Stephen Bullock, a brother of Story's. And he had started there because things were a bit cheaper. He was selling tires and fuel and butter and a usual little shop. And they had the 2 prams in the month of July or August. And lads pulled up in a car and said, get back, get up into that house. We're putting a bomb off here. And they ran and got back up.
That's a Story's Bullock's brother, Stephen.
Had
a little shop.
A few hundred yards below their house.
Yeah. It was a sort of temporary...
Kind of a prefab.
Prefab, yeah. And we went down, myself and my friend, we both had babies at the time and we were bringing them for a walk and we walked down there to across Ahalane Bridge and across over to Bullock's shop as far as there, and then we turned and came back, and as we were coming back, this car went past us coming towards Belturbet,
yeah,
same as we were, and the one fella turned down the window. He hadn't any mask or anything on, and he just said, keep going now, ladies, he said, a bomb is going to go off any minute.
So they ran out the prams and got into Bullock's house.
No, well, we didn't.
Or they just went to the house in the yard. No, but Nanny has a few minutes, the whole thing went up.
Oh, what was blown up?
His shop. And then tire. He used to sell tires.
And they caught fire.
Which were cheaper there than they were on this side. And the tires took fire. And then there was a great big blaze and a huge smoke from the tires and so on.
Right. where was it? Was that up in Timor?
Timor. Just across.
About 200 yards above that present house.
The custom posts were there at the time as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we came up past our custom post here, and on this side at the border, and Then Joan Bullock came out, and she tried herself, I think the custom man probably too did, tried to stop any cars coming on the road, because they knew something was going to happen, and they kept, we kept walking on as fast as we could.
Yeah. My goodness. Then. Yeah. Genie, man. Yeah. And that was on the Republican side.
Well, no, we were on the Republican side at that stage.
Back,
I mean, we had to come back across the bridge. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, but we're only talking about a couple of hundred yards.
A few hundred yards, you know.
I know, but it was in no man's land. So, like.
Well, it wasn't really.
But the customs guards, they were police, or were they?
No, the customs.
The customs were customs.
Customs men.
I know, Irish customs.
Yeah. Irish customs.
And their other customs on the other side.
British customs.
And then your British customs on the other side. And you were in the middle.
We were in the middle, yeah. Well, that was all the time. I mean, so that wasn't just that day. That was all
every
the time.
Every day, that was it. Yeah. Pass no remarks.
Yeah. I think it's extraordinary.
Did you get used to
it, that's extraordinary that, you know, people, we'll say Kerry people, were not aware of all those things.
But that's somebody should say to you with a baby in your pram.
Yeah.
And with Mrs. Bullock and a baby in her pram.
No, not Mrs. Bullock. No,
sorry,
it was a friend of mine.
A friend of ours.
And a friend.
And Mrs. Bullock came out then to us. Yes. Joan came out to us. Yeah, she was she's a lovely woman. And, she was very concerned about, afterwards she came up to our house to see how I was. And so
she was so full of shock.
No, I wasn't. No. Not at all. No, I wasn't.
But you had a baby, you know.
Do you do when you're told something like that? You just do what you're told, don't you?
Yeah.
If you're told to go and go whatever direction, keep out of danger, you're going to do that.
And this man had no mask at all?
There were four of them in the car. He was in the front passenger side. None of them had any masks, no.
And they weren't locals,
no,
were they?
No, I didn't recognise any of them, no.
Imagine. Was your house a safe house?
No. No, we were never asked.
No, we were never asked.
No.
Yeah, but, and you would never have, would you have supported them in any way, or would you have condoned what they were doing?
Well, I can only speak for myself.
Yeah.
And I never had, was never put in that position. But if somebody was trying to get away from the authorities, I would certainly hide them if I could, if I had some place to hide them. I wouldn't let them be caught.
Would you,
Anna? No.
And is that because you feel so? Why is the
question?
The question, yeah.
And I would feel that they were doing that because the whole question revolves around partition.
Right.
Isn't that the whole cause of all the trouble from the very beginning? And that's why these troubles erupted, and that's why they spark off from time to time, and they will continue to do that until partition is no longer there. Because it's all one island, all one country, and we are all one people. And the vast majority of the people in this country, regardless of what county they live in, they want to be a single unit. They don't want this partition, and they don't want all this trouble.
Can I come in there a bit when you talk about it? Yeah. You were asking about getting involved. From 1920 up on the collapse of Stormont, the Unionists felt very insecure, and the British government allowed them having the B-men. That would be young Protestant lads from 18 to 20, patrolling the road every night, harassing and watching their Catholic neighbours where they were going, walking and cycling, you know, number one. Number two then, when the trouble started, I had a cousin and a couple of them were working in Enniskillen. And the tricks that the British Army used to get up to blackmail ones. They were stopping the British Army one morning about 7:15 at a mile and a half from the house. And what was most unusual, my cousin was driving and they gave him a prod of the gun, pull the bonnet. When he pulled the bonnet of the car, another had to give him a prod, come out, open the boot. But when they got back into the car, one of the boys said, there's something happened. They normally only ask you to open a boot or a bonnet and you see what's going on. They went down the road about a mile and they pulled in into a laneway, and they got a half a dozen bullets was put in under the spare wheel of the car. When they went down to Derry Lynn another couple of miles, another British Army stopped them. They went in. They spent 3 hours. They knew the bullets was was in the booth of the car, and they couldn't find them. They put the seats and every damn thing out of the car and threw it at us under, but they didn't get the bullets because the boys had got them and threw them across the head.
Okay.
And the tactic, this happened on a number of occasions on people who heard, young people in particular. The army said,
and
right.
That happened to your first cousin?
Yeah.
What was his name?
It was Patrick, but I don't want that just mentioned. But this was a type of a tactic they used on young Catholics to blackmail them to get to be informed or get information. And they'd say, look, you're waiting a life sentence for that, for having them, or you have to cooperate.
Yeah.
Another case of another cousin, young couple after getting married, and they lived in a lane where there was about five houses on it.
Yeah.
And they were about halfway in the lane. And there had been a shooting in an adjoining town. And the police went out to them and said, you're hard working people and all that and good people. But you know, you might be able to help us. You know, and I know there's safe houses there on the lane. And all we ask you to do is write down the number, any car you see stopping.
Yeah.
And phone the confidential lane immediately. Well, two things. If you were there, in their situation, you didn't. Another family, they were newly married and they were living in this lane in a mobile home. And they had two small children. And there was an incident where someone was shot. The police came out and said, we know and you know there's two safe houses on this lane. There's the confidential number. Give us a ring. There's a law-abiding citizen. So they did nothing. And after about 5 or 6 weeks, the police came out and they said, what's going on? They had, we thought you were law-abiding, but you must be supporting IRA activity here. So they said they were supporting nothing. And and basically, people that didn't want to get involved, the best way was to see nothing, know nothing, and say nothing. But a few months after, it was outrageous what they did. They came at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they told the two of them, put them up, and they told the two of them to make contact with their parents or someone, or the two little children would be put into care. And they brought the husband to Goff Barracks in Armagh. And they grilled him for 36 hours. And they woke him up, threw water on him and that. And he wet and he soiled himself. And grilled him for 36 hours. And then the young wife was
telling me who he was, who that man still is?
No, he wouldn't want his name mentioned now.
Right, but you can, you know this, you know that.
Oh, so I do, yes, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
But, you know, and last night, if you had time, we could pick it up. On TG Carr, Jarlath Burns had a great bit on about the GA and the troubles. And we know it from cousins of mine. If you're seen of a son with a hurley, going to play hurling, while there wasn't much, there was a bit of it played, that was under the prevention of terrorism, that was an offensive weapon and a crime to be carrying a hurley in a car. So the army took took the sticks off you. If you had a fania, if you played Gaelic games, if you spoke Irish or anything like that, they lumped all together that you're anti-British and you're IRA.
But surely, with that type of intimidation then, and because you were living in a situation where you were, whether you like it or not, you were in no man's land. You were you had the British customs on one side of you, and you had the Irish customs on the other side of you. And you must tell me, did you have difficulty with both customs? Tell me about the Irish customs.
No, we had no difficulty with either customs. There was a custom man in a prefab hut both sides of the bridge, you know? And they come out and just say hello or look on the car or that, and that was it, and you went on about your business.
And can you remember the name of the Irishman, or was he...
it was different. It was different.
They were all different all the time.
I know, because...
They changed
quite often. I know, they changed quite often.
Yeah, but did you get to know them, and would you have got friendly with them?
Yeah. Oh, well, they'd be seeing, they'd be youngish fellows.
Would you bring them up a cup of tea, or?
They made tea for themselves, they had the facilities for making tea for themselves.
But your house was beside them, you know?
But we weren't just, you know, we were half a mile away from them.
Yeah. But the, getting back to the ones playing the football, they were cousins of mine around Tee Moore and Derry Lynn, and in a Sunday would be the team that there'd be matches on, and about half one of a Sunday, the British Army would have a checkpoint. And now, Joan Bullock actually checked it out for a number of ones that got harassed about how often they could stop you. Under the Prevention of Terrorism, you can be stopped for 2 hours. You can go 500 yards down the road. And another platoon can stop you for another 2 hours. And what would happen then, going to a match on a Sunday, boots and all would be thrown on the road, are going to be pointed at them. Say there's half on a match going for 3 o'clock. They'd be left sitting for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Just sitting, nothing. If you're going to play football,
so or that kind of
that was the kind of harassment they got.
Harassment.
Oh yeah.
And were you?
But that was ones now in the Fermanagh side.
Yeah.
Not here, but this was cousins. I mean, that was here regular about. You know, the harassment they got.
Sorry, O'Reilly's, is it? Or
No. Those were McGoldicks and Fitzpatrick's, different names, But no, when, and the GAA got an awful time of it because matches then. There'd be ones held up, different villages, disrupted, they might not arrive a match at 3 o'clock, it could be half four on the arrive.
But, so in fact, when you saw this bridge blown up, it didn't make that much difference to your life, other than the long journey around. Was that the reason why you upped and left there and moved in here?
No. Paddy's mother and father were living in the house as well. And Paddy's mother had a tourist business going. She had...
Up there in Ahaline as well.
Yeah. And then when we had children then, you know, well, things were a bit crowded, so we bought this house here. We came in to live here.
Excuse me, may I ring a bell? We were the safest house in the early 70s. There was guards. We had 3 guard sergeants. Sergeant O'Neill from Farton 4, a Sergeant Reedy from Carras Aveen, and the third sergeant, I can't remember, but they spent about 2 years up on my mother's house.
What was the first sergeant's name?
There was Sergeant O'Neill, he was around Farton 4, and Reedy was in Carras Aveen. Yeah. Now that's back in the early, they are dead and gone now.
And they used to stay in your house?
Oh, well, you didn't, there wasn't as much accommodation. And a number of ones was doing full board for English fishermen. And then the guards was looking. And my mother, at one time, she would have had up to 9 staying. 3 sergeants and 6 guards. The door was open 24/7 because the patrol car was going. Lads going to bed, lads coming in for tea and stuff. And my mother would cook meals during the daytime. And they had the freedom then at night, for 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, if they wanted to come in and make toast.
What was your mother's name?
Elizabeth O'Reilly.
And what was your dad's name?
Francis O'Reilly.
Right. And so they did quite a good bed and board breakfast there.
Oh, yeah, we had guards there for a number of years.
Yeah.
In the early part of the trouble. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then there was another woman, Francie Cahill, up there. His mother's dead since.
In the horseshoes.
His mother had a big house out at Leggy Kelly, and that was on the border too, heading for Clonus. And she kept guards at the same time. My mother and his mother, they would have kept 7 or 8 guards at the time. And it's
so it must have been the safest house.
The safest house in the country. Because there was always a garden bed or the patrol car going in and out the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd say we are probably the only one that you'll be meeting that kept guards.
Francie Cahill, but
his mother. Yeah. But they were the two houses that kept guards for a number of years. How many years did she keep them?
Oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 years.
Two or 3 years anyway. The local guards that was around, you see, keep them informed on things.
Yeah.
The guards that was coming up here.
They never asked the questions off the people that they were staying with.
They would be doing checkpoint.
They'd be doing
They wouldn't be getting deep. All of those guards from Cork and Kerry, they wouldn't be into the nitty gritty, you know, what's going on around here, like the local guards. Their job was checkpoints on the border, stopping cars and searching them with their guns or ammunition in them.
But they never asked in Paddy's home, they never asked his mother or father about anything regarding any people, any movements of people or anything. Never,
I know.
Never.
That wasn't their job.
No, that wasn't their job.
Their job was strange guards, checkpoints to make sure. after
they
the bombing.
Did their job and that was it.
The bombing, well, Turbot and that.
I'm sure there were inspectors or whoever there were then to go and find information if they wanted to, right. Wherever they got it.
But that low helicopter that you spoke about, the British helicopter, right. That flew over them, surely they must have asked questions.
Well,
about
now, that was before the guards came up.
It was,
you see. That was before the guards came on the border.
Oh, I see.
There was a massive amount of guards come
sent
up.
Sent up then.
Sent up from Cork and Kerry particularly, around here. You know, on 24/7, all them little roads, a patrol car beyond them every half hour. And them guards, that's basically what they were at, checking that there wasn't smuggling of guns or anything like that going on.
It was different then too, on farms. Like, at that time, whether they were Protestant or Catholic farmers tended to work and help other out, you know. And that always went on in the country. For instance, after the war, I remember the compulsory tillage we had up here, while you had poor land, you had to put in so many acres of oats. And when it become to cutting the oats, it took 15 to 16 men to physically lift the oats when there was a man going along with a machine and two horses cutting it. So whether it was Protestant or Catholic, if the man come in to cut the oats, and we knew it was going to happen tomorrow, we all went to the next. It didn't matter whether it was Harry or Willie or Paddy. You know, they worked together at that. And they worked together at threshing. When the oats being trashed, the thresher would come in to a townland or into a road. So it would start at the first house. Well, all the neighbours around would go to it. And then the next day and the day after, you'd also go to...
And that was all would. Very normal. But
it was, aye.
But there were so many other atrocities, as I say, and did that... Did you think for a moment, you know, look, this is going on and it's only happening beside us?
No, it became so common then from the 70s on, during the period from the 70s and 80s, you know.
What happened in our area here, the river dividing Cavan and Fermanagh, there was a bridge there called Ahalane Bridge, and that bridge was blown up. There's a
question.
Well, that's said. I don't think it was ever proven. It was said by the British Army. And the Cavan County Council put on, just immediately afterwards, they put on a Bailey Bridge on it. And that only lasted a very short time. It was also blown up. So that meant that the people living in Laggan townland and all the other townlands along the river Woodford, they had to go to Ballyconnell, a distance of about 7 miles, and then come back from Ballyconnell to Ahalane,
another seven,
14 miles of a round. That was the biggest inconvenience on a daily basis that people had. If they had to move cattle or if they had to do any of their farming activities, call on their neighbour to help them, that cut off the people of that area of Fermanagh from the area of Cavan here that ran along. And there was a whole generation of young people that didn't know that Cavan existed. They grew up with that completely cut off from their neighbours across the river. We had no social activity, nothing like that. Very few were prepared to do all this round of going 14 miles out of their way. It wasn't possible in a lot of cases to do that. So I feel that was a great disadvantage to the town of Belturbet here. Belturbet depended for that all those people to come in here to do their business, which they always had done, came to the bank here in Belturbet, and they came to, any transactions, any shopping they wanted to do, or anything they wanted, if they wanted to come to, a lot of them had a solicitor here that they would come to, all that came to an end. And it was a complete cut-off. I think that was what we saw within our own area. That was the thing that impacted on us most.
A local bank manager told us one time that when the bridge was blown up, that there were over 70 bank accounts of people in this end of Fermanagh. And that would have went back traditionally to prior 1921 and partition, that end, because before we had many cars, It was nearly 20 miles for them to go to Enniskillen. So you had a lot of South Fermanagh at that time, had their bank accounts. That more or less stopped, because in order for them to get to Belturbet, they would have had 14 or 15 miles of a detour. So then they opened bank accounts in Enniskillen or Listenskee. So the town of Poverise, Belturbet and Clonus were two towns that was totally poverised by the troubles. Mm. Roads bombed. And did
your own farming business suffer? Or did you use the border as a kind of a... Was it a help in smuggling and so on?
It was a help. I remember in very poor times in the 50s. People had boats along the river, both on the Fermanagh and Cavan side, and I often said they never used an oar. They brought a shovel across the river, because if you left an oar, someone would be smuggling. They wouldn't steal your boat. But if you were down the next day to look for it and you were in a hurry, it could be half a mile up the river or down the river from where you left it. But because money was so tight, the type of things now in the 50s that were smuggled, say, meal was £1.00 across the border. It might be 25 shillings or a couple of shillings, but money was that tight. So if they could save a couple of shillings on a few bags of meal, they would get their neighbour, the far side, to bring it down the horse and cart. You put it in and you brought it across in the boat. So there'd been plenty of things like meal and stuff was smuggled. Also, then there was times butter, there was difference in price, and sugar, any commodity that there was a few shillings to be saved on a bad time was smuggled.
And there was really very little smuggling done during the Troubles now,
yeah,
because there was so much surveillance of going on.
Up until the Troubles, in the 50s and 60s, there was plenty of smuggling. And then another thing, which might be relevant, come back just to the war years, to tell you something that only people on the border would know. There was rations for tobacco, and it was half, in the six counties in England, it was half an ounce of tobacco, and it was 10 cigarettes
per week.
Now, when the ration books come in, people that smoked in Fermanagh got every man and woman to be listed as smokers here, and my father and mother never smoked, but they got that, but my uncle and my grandfather smoked. And he'd come up every Friday night. Now, if the Northern Customs or our side Customs got you with a packet of 20 cigarettes, they'd take it off you.
And
they'd give you a receipt. But what my uncle used to do, a big cap, he would put the 20 cigarettes under his cap and they never took off his cap. And I remember him with a knife, then 2 ounces of Yachtman tobacco, cutting it into wee strips for his father. And he put it into his socks and had the socks over the trousers. They would make him empty his pockets and that, but they never asked him to pull down his socks or take off his cap. And that went on every weekend for years.
Yeah. And then when you had tragedies and incidences like the Bullock incident and that horrible killing, what happened? What happened in your house?
Well, it brought very clearly home to us that something terrible was going on. I mean, we might have heard, of course, we did hear everything about from Belfast, and we saw it on the television and so on, and Derry and all the other places. But when it actually happened in a townland just beside us, the reality of it, for me, the reality of it really hit. I was very, very shocked by it. Yeah.
And Paddy, you were, yes, what happened?
On both sides, we had him, Sanderson, the teacher. There were two Protestants that were shot. But we also had a man, Jim Murphy, below Derlin. He was 36. He was not involved in the IRA. He was in charge of the Pioneers, and he was chairman of the football club. And the army, there'd be ones in there, a little garage doing work, and for whatever reason, in the month of July, one evening, he had a white Peugeot car, and farmers would be calling late in the evening, but they didn't see his car going out, and the British Army going after it, and around to Knocknini where there was a key, and some of them twigged there was something wrong, why he was driving and the army after him. But when they went round, the army told them to get away, that it was a suspected bomb in the car, but it transpired the next morning that he was shot and his body was put on the boot of the car. That man. There was another case of a young married man, a butcher shop in Derry Lynn, and he was only a short time married. What's his name? Was it a Catholic fella? Mm. And he was actually shot in the head and his body put in the freezer, and he didn't turn up home, and his wife sent people to look for him. And it actually was the next day they couldn't, his car was there and they couldn't find him, the body was got in the freezer and they're in. So yeah, them type of things went on.
And did that worry the daylights out of you then? I mean, were you just, did you think this was normal?
Not very abnormal, of course it wasn't normal, no, it was very, it was shocking.
But we were aware of it. Then there was another case of the Catholic secondary school, the driver of it was in the UDR. The driver of the bus was in the UDR. And he was letting the children off one morning. And two boys stepped in and just as the last child got off and shot him in the head. Well, why did they do it? Why are you there, boys? He had two revolvers and a machine gun in the cab beside him. And they shot him to get the guns. He was also blamed for being involved in the killing of the man some months before, the Catholic man in the butcher shop. You know, these are the things you hear. And
but these are your neighbours. These people are your neighbours.
Yeah.
And also the perpetrators are your neighbours. You know that they.
Well, we wouldn't know them as individuals now. Who done what?
No, yeah. It probably wouldn't. The people who were the perpetrators wouldn't have come from the immediate area. It would have been a little further away. Mm. They wouldn't have been known personally to us.
So we, you know, kind of time has moved on now, and there is peace, and it's getting back to normal life, isn't it?
it's much more normal than it was. Let us put it that way. It's not completely normal, but it's a lot better than it was.
So you have a family.
Oh yes.
And so, what do they think now?
They would have been, you know, very young growing up. I mean, our children were all born in the 70s, so they wouldn't really have, they would have read about it, seen it on television, all that, but they wouldn't really have been, it wouldn't have impacted really on them an awful lot.
Do they think differently to you about... politics and
affairs? I would think that in a general way, they would feel that this country, for all kinds of reasons, not just the nationalist reason, but for all kinds of reasons, that the country would be much better if it were united and run as one unit. Yeah, even from an economic point of view. And of course, they would feel that, I mean, everybody would get their fair share. I think, I mean, in this part of the country, it's generally accepted, and it is a fact, that everybody, regardless of the religion or no religion or whatever they are, they all get a reasonably fair crack to get on with life and to make their own way and so on. And the supports are there mainly for them as well. Lots of things that could be improved, but in the main.
And the problems you had in getting jobs is now open to your family. They can get a job anywhere.
That was never the case with me. I didn't have a trouble getting a job, but I mean...
But you were explaining earlier on at the beginning
how... Your cousins, and tell them about your mother from the
mine. Oh, well, yes, but that was in an earlier age. An earlier generation. Yeah. And my own cousins, indeed, who lived in... who lived mainly in County Tyrone and bordering on County Armagh. And they had great trouble getting jobs. They did manage to get eventually, but I had one cousin who was well qualified and thought that that she would go for a job in her local area, and when she went for it, she was told that she needn't apply, that the job was already filled. You know, those are only simple little things, but that's how it was.
So now, it's an extraordinary story. You know, when you gather all these stories together and you talk to people, that you get a better understanding about what it was that was going on between the two sides.
Yeah, well, I suppose when you live in a county adjoining the border, I mean, we grew up being aware of that. Let's put it that way.
When people are intermarried, like my mother being from Fermanagh, we had a keen awareness. Anne's mother was one of 14, isn't it?
It was, yeah.
From Tyrone. And Anne's mother would never have met her father were it not for the fact that she was a nurse and another pal of hers, and they would only get part-time jobs until there was some young unionist fella, because the Horton Shore was chaired all boards and that. And then she came down to Cavan in the early 30s. And that's how. And then another uncle of Anne's also married. She was from South Armagh, yeah. His wife. And because they'd only get temporary work. You know, even after 5 or 6 years' experience, they'd be given to some young unionist an awesome job. So, you know, it'd be all of them things happened.
Yeah.
But I think that's well known.
That's well known.
It's not, yeah.
Of course, but when it reaches your door, like when it's part of your family.
Yeah.
Patrick, listen, thank you. And Anne as well, thank you.
Thank you.